Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Thanks so much for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. This episode's a real treat for me. This was really fun. I'm speaking with Jared Mankiewicz, and you may not know Jared's name, or maybe you do, but I guarantee you know some of his photos. For people listening who are like, rock photography, I don't know anything about it. Here's what I think is cool: getting to speak with people like Jared and other rock photographers. What I like is that you're getting like a side view of music. You're getting a different angle into the music. We're not taking apart Purple Haze. We're not talking about the specifics of Hey Joe or something like that, you know, about Jimi Hendrix. But you're getting to hear very intimate details of a photo shoot and photo shoots that he had specifically with Hendrix, with my favorite Hendrix photo of all time, which we're going to talk about, that is just fantastic, that Jared took. But He also talks about how he was a 19-year-old on tour with the Stones. He shot tons and tons of iconic Rolling Stone shots, and the cover of Between the Buttons. I mean, there's so many photos he's done that you would recognize. So this is just a treat of an interview to be able to speak to someone like Jared. You can follow him on Instagram at Jared_Mankiewicz, and he also has a website that's Mankiewicz.com. I'll put all that info in the show notes, but I want you to be able to go see his photos, because I know we're talking about the photos. But here's just a list of a few people he's photographed: Jimi Hendrix, the Rolling Stones, Traffic, Yardbirds, Small Faces, Elton John, Eurythmics, Duran Duran. It's crazy. So anyway, I want to introduce the interview. This is Jared Mankiewicz. Hey, this is Ryan, and I am so excited to be talking with Jared Mankiewicz. Jared, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Ryan. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. I tell you what, it is so cool to connect with someone like you. We've just been chatting for a little bit before the interview, and it's crazy because I've known your work, you know, way before I ever knew you, and it's just really cool, like, to see, to make that connection, to put an actual human voice with the work that they've done. So I love so many of your photographs and the ways that you've captured specifically rock musicians, and so I'd love for people to get to hear a little bit about your story. If you'd be willing, is it true that you dropped out of school at age 15 and got noticed for your photography skills? Is that true? Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, it is true, basically. The photography didn't feature very much in our family life. I mean, we all had, you know, we've all got snapshots of our childhood, but I don't remember, you know, my father or my mother being particularly keen on photography, but I was interested in photography from an early age because my father was a bit of a celebrity. He was a writer and producer, and so on occasions magazines would come to the house and shoot, you know, picture spreads on the family. So I was always very interested in the equipment, and then when I was about 11 or 12, he was working on a film with the great actor, comedian, Peter Sellers.
Oh, wow.
And Peter Sellers, who had just finished making Tom Thumb at the time, came to our house for Sunday lunch and to talk to my dad about the project. And Peter was a crazy amateur photographer fiend, and he brought with him a fantastic huge Polaroid camera, as well as a complete Hasselblad 500C kit, and I'd never seen anything like either of these extraordinary pieces of equipment. And he proceeded to take some amazing Polaroids of me with apparently my brother standing in my hand like Tom Thumb. Huh. And it was just magical. And then he allowed me to explore and play with the Hasselblad. He showed me how it worked and da 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 da. But he did the whole thing in a crazy, mad Swedish chef type voice. And I was weeping with laughter.
Wow.
And I associated, from that moment on, I associated photography with laughter.
Wow. How great is
and
that?
I said, I said to my dad, you know, I think I want to be a photographer and I want to have a Hasselblad. And he said, well, you're going to have to wait for a little while. But I persisted. I kept at him. And I was so bad at school. I was so bad academically that when I was allowed legally to leave school, he encouraged me and supported me. And I went to serve an apprenticeship with another friend of his who was a photographer called Tom Blau, okay, who owned a picture agency in London called Camera Press. They still exist. And I served an apprenticeship and was taught the basics with Tom Blau at Camera Press in London.
How essential to your growth do you think that apprenticeship was? I would think getting help from somebody like that at that age would be invaluable in being able to tweak your skill. Is that true?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have had a better introduction, although it was very commercial, but it covered everything. I mean, I was processing film. I was working in the darkroom assisting the printers. I was mixing chemicals. I was filing pictures. But most important of all, I had access to some of the greatest portrait photography that the world had ever seen. I mean, Carr Shavatawa, Arnold Newman, Irving Penn, Richard Avedon, all this work was accessible. And so as a 15-year-old kid, I was looking at some of the greatest photography. And that's what, you know, I was learning the basics. And that was really important. That gave me a sound, solid blueprint for my work moving forward. But looking at all this great work, being able to study this great work, not to mention looking at all the beautiful women they'd all photographed, it was pretty amazing.
Oh man, I bet that was incredible to be introduced to all that. So how did you make the jump then from apprenticeship, learning your craft? And then how did you jump into rock photography? That seems like a big jump. Was that people you knew, or like, how did that work out?
Well, I guess it would be seen as a big jump, but actually it was a reasonably smooth transition. And the main key to it was that I always imagined, because of my father's connection with movies and with the theater, that I would be in show business somehow. I always imagined that it would be, my photography would be something connected with show business. I guess because Peter Sellers was the one who sort of gave me my direction.
Yeah.
Not that he realized he had done that, but that. and so I always imagined that I was going to be in show business. And I started working in the theater quite early. I started photographing actors. And then two young actors who I'd got to know were also musicians, and they were called Chad and Jeremy. And they'd just been signed by the great John Barry, the composer, and at that time A&R man for a small independent company. And I was photographing Chad and Jeremy. My pictures were used on their first album. The record company that they signed to began to use me, give me shoots to do. And suddenly I found myself photographing young musicians, people who I related to. And I realized that this was showbiz. It might not have been the showbiz I had imagined I would be working in, but it was quite definitely show business. Huh. And I just took to it like a duck to water. It just seemed like a genre of photography, of commercial photography, that I could really embrace. And basically, that's what I did.
Well, I love that. And I love that, you know, I feel like in so many different stories and people's stories, whether it's musicians or people who work around music, so many times the thing we end up doing may not have been the thing that we expected to do, but you land there and then you thrive or not. But I love hearing that you were able to thrive in the thing in the rock photography world. How did you, I'm curious, because I love hearing that you were, you know, photographing guys or people that were, they were your own age. How did you get introduced to the Stones? What was the first introduction there?
Well, here's the thing. Chad and Jeremy opened the door for me because through them, I met Marianne Faithfull.
Mm.
And I met her socially through Chad and Jeremy. I immediately fell in love with her and asked her if I could photograph her. And she was very happy to have me work with her. So I whisked her off all over London photographing her. Mm. And she was managed by Andrew Lou Goldham, who managed the Rolling Stones. And although I didn't meet Andrew immediately, because he wasn't involved with Marianne on a day-by-day basis. And in those days, you know, Marianne, I just picked Marianne up at her flat, and we drive off in my little mini minor car, and we'd head off somewhere and take pictures. I mean, it was completely informal, you know.
Yeah.
And Andrew really loved some pictures I did of Marianne in a pub, which ended up by being used for her first album. But he then asked me if I'd like to work with the Stones. And so I met the Stones at his office at the end of 1964.
Okay.
And started working with them in 65.
And was the first way you worked with them, was it the Between the Buttons shoot, or did you work with them with live concerts first?
Well, the first shoot actually was the album. was a session in my studio, but out of it came the album sleeve for December's Children.
Okay.
Which is a black and white portrait of the band. So that was my, you know, that was a huge breakthrough, because only was I working with the Stones, but out of that first session, I got an album cover. They got so much fantastic material out of the session. We had such a great time that I sort of became one of their go-to photographers. I wouldn't want to say I was the official Rolling Stones photographer, because they didn't have an official photographer as such.
Yeah.
But they took me to America at the end of 65 for the fall tour from October through until December.
And you were on tour with the Stones for months. I mean, what was that like? That just sounds crazy. I bet that was incredible. You're seeing them at like the peak live time. I saw them like a year and a half ago, and it blew my mind. And I can't imagine what they sounded like and what the roar was like when this was first happening. I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, so yes, it was completely crazy, and to go to America for the first time, you know, traveling first class on TWA,
that's awesome,
with the Stones, no one else, just the Stones, their roadie Ian Stewart and me. I mean, there was no one else.
Man.
You know, these were early days,
yeah,
and no security, no sound people, no guitar techs, no nothing, you know. And I didn't know any better. It was the fourth Stones tour of America, so they were quite experienced, but it was the first tour I think since Satisfaction. And Get Off My Cloud was the hit of the tour. That was number one while we were on the road. So that was a
Gosh.
Big deal.
That's awesome.
But it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There was a little bit.
Sure.
There was a little bit. But it hadn't really got to the sort of degenerate,
yeah,
crazy later 60s madness, you know.
Got it.
It was pretty crazy for a kid. I mean, I was just 19, so it was pretty crazy for a 19-year-old.
That's wild. Well, before the call, you and I were talking about how I'm in Texas, around the Dallas area, and you were telling me the story about when they played two shows in Texas on the same day. Can you talk about that specific date? Anything you remember about that?
Well, when you told me you were in Dallas, yeah. I just immediately remembered that when I went on this tour, Dallas and Fort Worth were two entirely separate cities, and the Stones played an afternoon concert in Fort Worth and then drove to Dallas to play an evening concert there. And I remember it. Yes, I remember it pretty well because we stopped on the road for a hamburger at an amazing hamburger joint that was all glass at the front. And for some unknown reason, Brian had decided he didn't want to eat. So he stayed in the car, and we all marched in, and we got our hamburgers, and we were all chomping away, enjoying our burgers. And we stepped out. As we stepped out, Brian came out of the car and said he changed his mind. And so he went into the burger place, and we were all in the car ready to go, and we could see him. He was just about the only person sitting in the window, you know. We could see him in the glass, and he was smiling at us. And Andrew was so infuriated by this sort of prima donna moody behavior, yeah, and the fact that we were running late, he sent one of the drivers in to get him, and he said to him, drag him out, you know, if you have to, just drag him out by the scruff of his collar. So we had this funny little show. We're all in the car, we're looking at this glass-sided hamburger joint. This driver, who looked like he'd stepped out of The Sopranos, sort of marched up to Brian, and we could see him talking to him, saying, you know, you got to get out. Brian said, you know, I'm eating my burger. And the guy just grabbed him and sort of frog marched him out with hamburger flying out of his mouth. Anyway.
What a story. Yeah. Oh, man. Hey, you know what? I take a little bit of pride there that you had a burger all those years ago in Texas, and it still left a mark. That left a memory. So I take pride in some Texas burgers, but it's a cooler story that it was with the Rolling Stones on tour in 65. That is a great story. Well, what's it like when you were in a setting like that where you're traveling with the guys? I assume you become close to them. Is it hard to, like, remember that you're on the, not on the job, but like, is there a sense of my job here is to capture the moment, and so even if it's awkward, I'm going to take photos? Or was it ever that kind of thing? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Funnily enough, it was never awkward, because it had been made very clear to me that really all they wanted was on stage and backstage. It was made very clear to me that the hotels, the aeroplane, that was off camera, private time, not because a lot of stuff was going on.
Sure.
It wasn't. But simply because Andrew he didn't want the Stones to be filmed in the same way that the Beatles had been. You know, the Beatles had done a load of, they'd done a load of stunts. They would be filmed in swimming costumes doing leapfrog on a beach, or they'd be, you know, there was nothing hidden. And Andrew felt that was a mistake, and he wanted this to be mystery about the Stones. And so I knew, I was working the same hours as the band. You know, I was traveling with them in the same cars, staying in the same hotels. There was no separation. There was no differentiation between our circumstances on the road. Mm. And when they went out to perform, I did my job and took pictures. And I took pictures in the dressing room. But then I packed up my cameras, and I didn't take them out until the next gig. Now, I regret that in some ways because I think I got an incomplete story. Mm. But that was, you know, I completely understood my instructions, if you like, and it never occurred to me to try and sneak pictures. Apart from anything else, Ryan, I was one of the band to all intents and purposes. So when they went off to see Solomon Burke in Miami or James Brown at the Apollo, I was with them. And when we all went to dinner, I was with them. When we were swimming in Florida, I was with them. So I was having too nice a time, and you know, it never occurred to me to sort of break the rules. You know, my relationship with the band and with Andrew were too important to me. I didn't have any other loyalty. You know, it wasn't like I was working for a newspaper or something like that.
Well, I would think that that would greatly elevate your trust in the level, like within the band, to trust you more, you know, being able to abide by those boundaries. So that totally, I mean, that makes sense.
Yes.
And that's interesting. Yeah, and that's interesting hearing about the Beatles, because they certainly, that's really interesting hearing that that was like a tactical, that was a purposeful move. The types of shots were different, especially at a time when I think people were really, you know, you wanted to differentiate the difference between the Beatles and the Stones. These are very different bands, even though they're constantly being compared. That's interesting. Well, I wonder if you would indulge me on some Jimi Hendrix questions, because your photo shoot with him is, I mean, it, for me, they are the images I associate when I think of Hendrix. They are from photos that you have taken. So first, I'm curious, before, did you do one photo shoot with him or multiple photo shoots with him?
I actually did two.
Okay. Were you familiar with his music before you took his photo, or how did that introduction go?
Well, here's the thing. Nobody had heard of Jimi Hendrix when he first arrived in London. Mm-hmm. Chaz Chandler, who managed Jimmy and who had brought him over from New York to London to sort of launch a solo career, he had asked me, he said, I've got this amazing guitarist. He looks fantastic. I'd like you to photograph him. And he invited me down to a very, very early gig, one of the very first gigs that the band put on in order to try and introduce them to the media, to the music business, et cetera, et cetera. And I went in and I saw Jimmy playing, and I thought he looked absolutely fantastic. I wanted to photograph him immediately. He was performing like an absolute maniac. And nobody could understand how he was making the music that he was making, because the, you know, the guitar was the wrong way round. It was strung upside down. God knows how he did it. He was playing with his teeth behind his head. All those tricks.
Yeah.
The thing was that the music actually went over my head at that point. And I it was too much for me. I couldn't really cope with it. But I met Jimmy very, very briefly. We just said a couple of words. Chaz said, you know, I'll book a session with you. I'll book a session with you as soon as we can. But that actually ended up as not happening until I think it was February in 67. And Hey Joe was just about to be released, or just been released, but he still hadn't had a hit when I first met him. He was still, there was a buzz about him. He and the Experience had been out on the road getting practice, trying to get tight, but he hadn't had a hit.
I wonder if, one, I can't believe you got to see him live. I'm a guitar player, and he's my number one, just best ever. So I'm super jealous that you got to do that. But I'm jealous in meeting him. Do you remember, like, when you actually went to shoot his photo? They're very intimate portraits, they're very close up, the ones of just him. Do you remember anything about the session? Like, I wonder, I spoke to someone who talked about when he met John Coltrane, saying that he had the softest hands he had ever felt in his life. I wonder, do you remember anything specific around the memories of actually shooting him?
Well, I do, of course. I remember it reasonably well. I'm not sure how accurate my memories are, but I have memories which I cherish. He was very quiet, very gentle, very modest. Hmm. He had great hands. It's interesting because his hands feature a lot in my portraits of him. And his fingers were extraordinarily long and delicate. And he was really thin. I mean, the guy was really thin. He had the perfect rock star shape. You know, he was tiny, but was quite broad and had what seemed like quite a large head, exaggerated by this
wild hair.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was very, very sweet, funny. He was funny. We all laughed a lot. But back in those days, people didn't want to be photographed smiling. You know, it wasn't cool to be photographed smiling, in the same way that it wasn't cool to be photographed with your musical instrument in the studio. That was old. That was late 50s, early 60s. That was something we were trying to get away from. So no guitars in my pictures, just the person. And I'd made what I think was a genuine decision at the time, but I regret making it. I decided that I wanted to take Jimmy seriously, and I wanted to treat him as a serious musician. I didn't want to treat him as a sort of passing pop fad. I wanted to treat him as a serious musician, and I thought that, you know, black and white was the format for serious portrait photography, and so I only shot him in black and white. And he was lovely to work with. He was very easy to work with. I didn't feel I was under any pressure. I fed him. I'd learned by 67. I'd learned that almost all musicians were hungry all the time. And, you know, feeding people, breaking bread with people is the best way to get relaxed and chilled and take the pressure off, take some of the adrenaline out of the situation. And also, you know, it's a curious thing, but most people, not everybody, but most people don't like having their photographs taken.
And
that applies to an awful lot of musicians. There were a few, perhaps, who enjoyed showing off to the camera, but the bulk of them didn't really like it. So part of my job was to try and make the experience as easy and as comfortable for them, and to not necessarily tell them how to pose, but to try and explain to them how a portrait was made, to try and communicate how to communicate back into the camera. And I think that was really part of my job. And with Jimmy, I was lucky enough to have a subject who embraced what I was talking about and gave me the intimacy, the access through the way he looked at the camera that made the photographs particularly important and relevant. And, well, as you very sweetly said, you know, some of the most important photographs of Jimmy ever taken.
No doubt. Like, oh man, for me, and you made a good point about musician. Well, you made two things stuck out that really resonated as somebody who knows a lot of like music pictures and photographs through the years. I, you know, specifically not having instruments in the studio. That's like an unspoken thing that I would not necessarily have thought. But once you said it, it's like, yeah, you never saw pictures of the Beatles with like a bass guitar, you know, posing in the studio. So that totally makes sense. And then, you know, being able to try to get them to communicate in some way through the photo. I think that's interesting. And specifically when you talked about earlier about laughing, and how that was how you were introduced to photography, is that something you would implement, is trying to make people at home by having fun or by laughing in the shoot? Is that something?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, everybody, and I'm talking about, I guess I'm talking about men and women, but the majority of the people I was working with at this time were men and young men, and they all wanted to be, you know, to look mean, moody, and sexy. Mm. And that didn't include smiling. And, you know, cheesy smiling pictures were old showbiz, and yeah, we were trying to always get away from that. That was our aim, was to reject the sort of the 50s and the early 60s imagery and try and be harder and tougher and grittier and grainier and funkier, really. Okay. But the actual, when you look through the session, there are a lot of, well, several absolutely beautiful Jimi Hendrix smiles, which I personally love. I mean, my favorite pictures actually are of him smiling. And But they weren't used. They weren't actually used, and we were always trying to be, you know, staring into the camera, being mean, moody, and sexy.
Yeah, that's funny, because while we're talking, I purposely had the shoot pulled up, and yeah, there's several in there where he is full out smiling, and you don't see those a lot, but they're great photos. But I tell you what, my favorite one, if I had to pick one Hendrix photo out of any that I've ever seen, my favorite one is the one that you did where he's smoking. And he's exhaling smoke, and he's kind of smiling. His arms are kind of crossed. He looks really confident, and he also looks very relaxed. And to me, it's just like, man, that's the Hendrix photo.
Yes.
I just love that.
Well, that's one of the most famous of the pictures. That's called, I mean, that is called Jimi Hendrix smoking. And he's exhaling. He's got a fantastic grin. Mm-hmm. He looks loose. He looks a bit stoned, but it's not a joint. It's just a regular cigarette. And I guess people, you know, an awful lot of people who will listen to this, I guess, don't perhaps appreciate that everybody smoked. Back in the 60s, we all smoked almost continuously everywhere. You know, in restaurants, in the subway, in theaters, in movie houses, everybody smoked. We must have stank. You know, we must have all smelt like old ashtrays. It must have been absolutely disgusting. But everybody did it. So smoking in the photographs, we never questioned that. In fact, you know, a lot of the great images, the great moody images of the 60s, jazz images, for instance, of the late 50s, early 60s, had a lot of smoke in them.
Yeah.
You know, and smoking was, we thought that was cool. And you need to get into that headspace of the time, because now smoking is such a taboo, and of course is so appallingly bad for you. A magazine recently wanted to publish smoking, and they asked me if I could retouch the cigarette out.
How funny.
Yeah, it was funny, because I didn't know what I was supposed to do about the smoke that he was exhaling. And I guess it was just, you know, people desperately trying to be PC and smoking is certainly a great picture.
Oh man, yeah, it adds to the mood for sure. Was there a point when some of the Hendrix photos you took did not get released until the early 90s? Was there something about that that some were held back and they didn't get released till later, or am I making that up?
No, you're not really making that up. But it's not as though they were consciously held back. What happened was, at the time, I'd made this decision not to shoot color. And Chaz, as far as I remember, was very supportive of that. And everybody loved the pictures that I did at the time, except the record company wanted color. Mm. And the idea of doing a black and white cover, just even though the Beatles had done a black and white cover, you know, the Stones had done black and white covers with me, for some reason, whether or not it was the record company itself, I will never know. Mm. They wanted color. And so my pictures got sidelined quite quickly. I have no real recollection of how they were used at the time. But they certainly weren't widely seen at the time. And so they stayed in my archive. And it wasn't until in 82, I had an exhibition, the first exhibition of music photography ever in the UK. And I put in one Hendrix picture, funnily enough, a close-up, not even the whole picture, a close-up of that smoking face. And that was the first time I ever showed a picture. And then in 92, I had a much bigger solo exhibition, and I put up a lot of Hendrix stuff, and they went down a storm. And then Hendrix's estate was managed at that time by a fantastic character called Alan Douglas, much disliked in the business, but we loved him. He was great for me and great to work with. And he loved what I'd been doing with my Hendrix work. And we'd made a beautiful silkscreen picture of it. And he asked for that to be used as the cover of a compilation album called The Ultimate Experience.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that was what really brought my work on Hendrix to the attention of the public. So you're quite right, it was the early 90s, but it wasn't that they were held back, it was just that they were only rediscovered, if you like, at that point.
How cool. Well, that's cool for like somebody like me who I didn't get into them until the early 90s, you know, because I was in junior high at that time, and it was like, oh gosh, there's new, you know, this is like a new representation of Hendrix with the new pictures and in the remastered or whatever they did, a new collection of music. And anyway, that's cool to hear you describe how that was kind of introduced to even a larger audience. And thank you for indulging me on the Hendrix questions. I just love that you have such specific interactions with him and great photographs to come out of it. The last question I want to ask, and we'll see what's next for you. We were talking a little bit earlier about you have some cool upcoming stuff. You were one of the executive producers for the Icons Music Through the Lens. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's right. Well, for years and years, I felt that music photography as a genre was simply not taken seriously. And I've been battling since 1982 to try and get my work shown and accepted as creative, artistic photography. But, you know, the extraordinary thing about music photography is that every music fan, and let's face it, almost everybody you know is a music fan of some sort of music.
Yeah.
Every music fan has album sleeves. I'm talking in the old days. I know people don't have sleeves anymore.
Yeah,
more's the pity. But if you're really, you know, most people in their father's collections or even their grandfather's collections will be conscious of album covers. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, I don't know where you first discovered Hendrix, but a lot of people of your generation would have found Hendrix in their father's record collections. Mm. And with it was a picture, mm-hmm. an album sleeve. So millions of music fans had these iconic images, which they sort of took for granted. They were just part of the wallpaper. They were part of the scenery. They were, but they were an important and crucial element in the experience of music. So I wanted that taken seriously. And about 10 years ago, actually nearly more like 12 now, I met at a big music conference here in the UK. I met a director called Dick Carruthers and a colleague of his called Andy Saunders. And we were having breakfast in the hotel, and I said to them, do you know, there's never been a serious documentary film about music photography. And they stopped in their eating and they said, no, come on, there must have been. I said, no, there's never been a proper study of music photography. Hmm. And they said, well, we got to do it. And we formed a partnership, and we then spent 10 years trying to sell the idea. And at the end of 2018, we got the go-ahead, and we shot throughout 2019. And then Dick, the director, he edited everything during lockdown from home.
Wow.
And we sold it, and it's going to be broadcast in America in the summer. I can't tell you exactly when or on what station, but all I can say is that it will be very, very widely available across America at some point in the summer. I wish I could give you more details, but I'm not allowed to. And hopefully it will be announced before this podcast is broadcast. And if it is, then you can add a little sort of caption voice to this at this moment and say it's going to,
That's perfect. And you know what? And if the info hasn't been released by the time this is airing, people that are listening to the podcast, be sure and follow me on Instagram. It's Songs of Note, or you can follow Jared Mankiewicz on Instagram, and we'll be posting about it. I have no doubt that's going to be fascinating based on our conversation here, and just can't wait to watch it. Jared, it's been just a true pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today, being willing to share some of your stories, and just grateful for the work that you've made.
Well, thank you, Ryan. That's very, very kind of you. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and the best of luck with your podcast. I hope people really enjoy it, and follow me on Instagram, and have a look at my website, mankiewicz.com.
Absolutely.
And have a look at lots more stuff.
Awesome. And I'm going to put links to that in the show notes for people listening. It's going to be mankiewicz.com, where you can follow Jared online, and all the links. So, Jared, just greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for coming on.
Great talking to you. Stay well and stay safe.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.